But we're going to focus on the book Shaken. And the reason we're doing this is because the church encouraged us to read this book in July. And so what I wanted to also do is add in a second book that Tim Tebow has coming out. He was supposed to do some interviews, but he's still doing very well in baseball right now, so he's not available for interviews. He's gone from AA to AAA, and who knows, before the end of the season, he might be playing for the New York Mets. As poorly as the Mets are doing, why didn't they bring him up right now? They could certainly improve that. So with that as a background, I wanted to begin by having you see a little bit of his video introducing the book.
I think staying grounded is one of the hardest things we will ever do in our life. In life, you're going to have a lot of highs and lows. And eventually, everything around you will be shaking. So what do you have to hold on to? Who are you and whose are you? I've been traveling for the last 3 or 4 years, speaking all over and being able to see so many people in today's society that are searching. There is more to this world than money, fame, and power, that you can have an impact no matter who you are. And I feel like this book about identity, about not being shaken, about being able to have a firm foundation as a child of God is something that so many people are longing for and wanting, because they're searching for, there's got to be something more. There's got to be more out there. What is it? What is it? Well, I can tell you what it is. It's a relationship with the God of this universe who loves you so much. It was fun in this book to be able to highlight role models of mine that have been able to find a firm foundation in whose they are no matter what life throws at them. I'm so thankful because of my relationship with Jesus Christ and being adopted in the family of God that I don't have to live the highs and the lows and the roller coaster that the rest of the world lives of my life. And when you realize that you matter to the God of this universe, it changes everything for you. You realize you're not an accident. You're not a mistake. You have purpose. There is a plan for your life, and you are loved and you are special. That changes how we view ourselves. That changes who we are.
You need a great role model? Nick, if you want to have a good role model, there it is right there, you know. And matter of fact, my wife has had a chance to get to know his mom, so it comes from a great family. And as you go through this book, you'll learn a little bit more. So if you would, for those of you that actually have access to a smartphone or a tablet, we've also posted it on the website, prestonwoodexamined.org. But let's go through the outline here. And my goal was to cover this book primarily, but then take just a couple of key principles from the new book, which is really full of practical suggestions. So I'm going to give you just a couple of verses and other things that reinforce it. And then last week when I spoke on the issue that we dealt with the case for Christ, Gwen asked a very good question. And by the way, you're able to ask questions and I try to answer those. And that was, in light of what we read in Genesis, you had said that the Jews did not understand the Trinity, but couldn't they have picked up some of that by reading in the book of Genesis? So I'm going to try to answer that question today, and I'll answer some of the other questions a little bit later. I think we'll have enough time, but again, if I'm getting too long-winded, EJ will just grab the hook and pull me off, and we'll cover it next week, okay? So that's what we're going to do. But let's get into the issue of Shaken. Unfortunately, the titles are there, but they aren't showing up on the computer here. But nevertheless, in the opening part of his book, Tim Tebow really asked a very good question after being cut by the New England Patriots. I'm going to play a little bit of an audio later on where he talks about being cut by Bill Belichick and thinking that that was sort of the end of his life. And so early on in the book, he says, you know, when your world is shaken, when the plans and dreams you've created, perhaps even banked on, get obliterated, when the path on which you walk is moving in an unknown and particularly unwanted direction, what do you do? Better yet, what do you hold on? And so this is the idea of first being cut and then really understanding some of your priorities. And so he spends some time really helping us understand that he, even though he looks very successful, knows what it's like to have been cut. Some of us know what it's like to have been fired. Some of us know what it's been like to be rejected. Many of us have faced in this classroom here various health reversals. And so what do you do when your world is shaken? So he really kind of helps us understand some of those. If you're taking some notes along the way, I'm going to give you some of these key verses. And as I went through the book, I thought it would be good to put these verses maybe on an index card, maybe try to memorize them, put them on a refrigerator. Maybe I'm thinking about putting it on a screensaver, something like that, so that when there are times that come, I will have God's Word instantaneously giving me some feedback. And of course, one of the best known verses would of course be in Jeremiah 29 verse 11. For I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans for welfare and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope. That's from a New American Standard Version. I think the one New English Version also talks about calamity in a variety of different ways. But whatever version you find, that's the one he uses in the book. Just to remind that God still has a plan. Psalm 56:3, when I am afraid, I will put my trust in you. And this idea, in God we trust, we talk about. We see it in our money. Some of that comes from some of these verses in the Psalms. And he said, God created you for a reason. He created you to be special. He created you for a purpose. In the second book that Tim Tebow has coming out, Know Who You Are, Live Like It Matters, he really drives that home, because this is primarily aimed more at a youth audience. Although, as I read through it, I thought, well, you know, I'm three times the age of the target audience here, and I'm learning some things out of here. But nevertheless, it is really driving home the idea of purpose. And at a time when we recognize that the teen suicide rate has zoomed through the roof, one of the things I want to try to cover next week are these articles that have come out, one in The Atlantic, Have Smartphones Ruined a Generation? And also then one that came up a few days later in the new, National Review, Yes, Smartphones Have Ruined My Generation, from a millennial. And the article written by Gene Twinge points out that when you looked at kind of the teen suicide rate, it's done like this, it's been kind of a gentle curve, but after 2012, it shoots up, interestingly enough, like a steep mountain cliff. And her argument is that in 2012 is when at least 50% of the people in our population, American population, had smartphones. And when you start talking about all the other things, of course, just the dismal world that we live in sometimes, and all the climate change issues that you hear, and racism in the news, and fear now of nuclear arms and North Korea, and on and on. And then you add to it the FOMO, the fear of missing out. Everybody's having a good time but me, or the cyberbullying, which we talk about quite a bit at Aim for Success. You can see that that has gone up dramatically. So this is, I think, even more important for a young generation to take some of the great material from Tim Tebow and apply it to their lives. Let me continue on. He quotes from Rick Warren. I love this, because this is the idea of fear and love that he talks about. Fear is a self-imposed prison that will keep you from becoming what God intends for you to do. You must move against it with the weapons of faith and love. He also has a quote from Martin Luther King Jr. Faith is taking the first step even when you don't see the whole staircase. Of course, there's Indiana Jones. Remember that one? You know, okay, you all remember that one, taking that first step. And then if you wanted a verse, again, to put down here, Jesus says, here on earth you will have many trials and sorrows, but take heart, for I have overcome the world. So again, lots of great promises that come out of this book that I thought were very encouraging, and one of the reasons why Pastor Graham suggested that we read it in July. Then he gets into this issue of criticism. How do we deal with that? And if you think you get criticized, just imagine the kind of visibility that Tim Tebow receives. First of all, he gets a lot of criticism just because he's a Christian, right off the bat. Then he gets criticism from all the Monday morning quarterbacks that are convinced that he can't throw the ball, and all the other things that are there. And so he said, criticism hurts. It's hard to hear harsh words from a journalist you might never meet in person. It's harder to hear the same from a trusted friend. But then he talks about the fact that even though we hear criticism from a friend, from a journalist, the biggest critic is what? Oftentimes, he said, there's another critic who usually flies under the radar, you and me. Sometimes we are our own worst enemy. Consider what you've thought about yourself in the last week, or even in the last 24 hours. Boy, that was stupid. I can't believe you did that. Boy, looking in the mirror, wow, I really look terrible today. You know, all the kinds of things that we say to ourselves, and we are self-critical. And so that's, again, another issue that he wants us to begin to address, because that can shake us well. We sometimes might be going through it. People say, your life is really great. You say, yeah, but if you knew what was inside me right now, the criticism I've received from others and the criticism I have of myself, you understand why it's really hard for me to put a smile on my face. Then he goes on to say, I can't tell you why bad things happen or why our dreams and plans shatter. It's an age-old question that people have asked for centuries and will continue to try to answer. But he goes on to say that we'll try to answer it, debate it, and write books about it. But then he said this is something Job talks about. And in the book, he spends a little bit of time taking us through Job being righteous, nevertheless facing all sorts of trials and difficulties, and just reminding us of that biblical story. And he said, it may not be easy for you right now to fully trust God with your heart or your circumstances. There are times I struggle to believe that he's got everything already worked out. So again, the premise of shaking is you're going to have times when you're shaken. You're not going to be able to avoid those times when your life is shaken. The real question is how you're going to respond when your life is shaken. And then he goes on to talk about the fact other people, which is good. It's important to recognize that kind of in this North American Christianity, we're kind of the lone ranger. We're the individuals that sort of just do it ourselves. And so in a sense, we don't really understand the importance of having other people in our lives. John Donne said, no man is an island, or I didn't know it, but he quotes from Bear Grylls of all people. A man's pride can be his downfall, and he needs to learn when to turn to others for support and guidance. And he says sometimes we don't reach out. We don't have an opportunity for others to pray for us, to encourage us, to actually speak into our lives. And he says we have a tendency to turn inward. I don't need anyone. I can get through this on my own. And so it's a reminder that sometimes when we're going through things that shake us to the core in our faith, to really begin to understand how important it is to have others in our lives. So then he talks about this idea of having people in your circle of influence. And so he says, who is in your circle? And that would be a good question to ask yourself. Who's in my circle? Who can I depend on? Who's there? One of the individuals that I've heard speak here at the church over the years has said, who will be my pallbearers? Which is, I thought, kind of interesting. Who are going to be the six guys that are going to carry my casket? You know, that's a way to think about your circle of friends, or who are the people that are speaking into your life? And again, he gives us some examples here. Proverbs 13, verse 20. He who walks with wise men will be what? Wise. But the companion of fools will suffer harm. So it isn't just having a good a circle of friends, but it's having a good circle of friends. Individuals that are wise and discerning and can speak into your life and actually help carry that yoke sometimes and really begin to encourage you. Who's in your circle of trust? It doesn't have to be a good group of people or a big group of people, but it has to be some people that certainly are those that you will trust. Then he talks about this issue. One of the chapters is normal, which I kind of love there. He said, many spend their lives wondering if they're normal or wanting to be. And he says, it's funnier, the particulars of being normal are always changing. And he didn't go into this, but I was thinking about that. Think about what normal was in the 1950s. For some of us have been old enough to remember what normal was in the 1950s. Think of what normal is today in the 21st century. And it shows how that's changed rather dramatically. Just think of what it would be normal fashions for women just even two decades ago. What would be considered normal fashions for women today? And certainly what are normative ethics three or four centuries or even three or four decades ago? What are considered normal ethics today? So again, this is just a reminder that sometimes whatever is normal may be really, from God's perspective, abnormal. And if we're going to be really godly men and women, we need to be counterculture. We need to be swimming upstream. So then he says, sometimes we celebrate what's unique. And I loved it. Tim Tebow said he was grateful that he was dyslexic. Well, that's kind of a a jarring thing, but whatever your particular uniquenesses might be to really camp on what God has made you unique. In some respects, there's never going to be another person like you. Even if you're a twin and you're genetically identical, two twins oftentimes, even if they're genetically identical, are very different. I have nieces, Sarah and Julie. They were so identical that my brother and sister-in-law sometimes had trouble keeping them straight. The way you kept them apart and figured out who was by their personality. Because Julie's the life of the party and Sarah was Eeyore. So you could tell real quickly that even though they were genetically identical, hard for even mom sometimes to tell them apart, you could tell them apart by their personalities and how they actually begin to go. One goes into computer programming, one goes into pre-med. So again, you know, genetically identical, ended up in the same school. Sometimes switch clothes and switch classes to confuse the teachers, but nevertheless, very different in their personalities. And back to the point I'm making is, there's never going to be another person like you on this planet. Genetically, you are unique. Emotionally, you're unique. In terms of your spiritual gifts, you're unique. And I think one of the real challenges is to say, what does God want me to do with my unique set of gifts and abilities in this world that we find ourselves? And again, another praise verse, which I put up there, James 1:17, he put it in there. Every good thing and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father. Another one for your index cards if you wanted to begin to talk about that. Then he talks about the idea of standing up. What does that mean? Well, first of all, he quotes the famous phrase from Mark Twain. It's not the size of the dog in the fight, it's the size of the fight in the dog. And so again, the need for us to stand up and to be bold. And again, you got to appreciate a guy that's been willing to put on his eye black, John 3:16, a guy that's willing to go and pray in the end zone, to go do what's called Tebowing, to stand for his faith when people were criticizing him. You think of others standing for their faith right now, and that is the case. And he points out that the stand you take may not be the biggest deal in the world, but it can be a big deal for one person. Sometimes when we say, well, I need to take a big, bold vision. Well, it says you can't feed all of Africa, but you could go and feed one person in Africa. You know, you can't save the whole world, but you can go on a mission trip here at Prestonwood and go down the Amazon. You can go to Romania. You can go to the Sudan. You can go to all sorts of different places and make a difference in a number of individuals' lives. But then he does talk a little bit about what he's done. And if you're not familiar with the story, I was going to pull this clip, but I wasn't sure I had enough time. Because he was on, interestingly enough, a talk show where they were talking about what happened when he put the eye black. You know what eye black is, right? And he would have John 3:16 on there. Well, after he did this in the championship game for Florida, the coach got a phone call. And he goes, and said, I just found out that because you put John 3:16 up there, they've done an estimate that 94 million people in America and around the world Googled John 3:16. Isn't that pretty amazing? And then somebody, a sports analyst, went back, and I've just put a part of it because this goes on for about a paragraph, that it turns out in that game, Tim Tebow threw for 316 yards. Yards per completion was 31.6. That's supposed to be a point there. Time of possession, I reversed those, it's supposed to be 31 minutes and 6 seconds. So there were all sorts of 316 kind of numbers that were associated with that as well. So I thought that was just an illustration again of what in some cases seemed very incidental. Still, again, 94 million people don't know what John 3:16 is. Isn't that amazing? But if nothing else, it just illustrates that you have an opportunity to make a difference. And when you're on a big stage, there's an opportunity to make a big impact. Then he talks about the need for us to really get involved in other people's lives, to minister to others. And one of his phrases he says is oftentimes, one of my favorite sayings is, we don't dream big enough. And oftentimes we don't start small enough. And that is to illustrate some of the things he's done. He says that since he was really in high school, as far as I can remember, And of course he was homeschooled, so that's a kind of a different category, but through the church he was in prisons, and he talks about some of his experiences in the prisons and reaching out to others. But then of course the Night to Shine event that I think many of us are familiar with because it's been taking place in here, and then even spending time with the Wish Kids, just a lot of examples of where he really has recognized that I'm not just a football player, I'm a minister of Jesus Christ. I'm not just a football player, but I'm an ambassador for Jesus Christ. So I hope that you'll begin to think about, you know, I'm not just a businessman, an accountant, lawyer, doctor, homemaker, whatever it might be, but I'm also an ambassador, and there's just a great opportunity for us to make a difference. And then he quotes in this chapter there, what matters most, from the movie Gladiator, where Maximus, before they're about ready to engage this battle in Germany, what we do in life echoes in eternity. Just a reminder that what we do and what we say makes a difference. There is an eternal consequence and internal significance to what we do, and to really begin to evaluate that. So that was perhaps quick, maybe if Tim Tebow were here, maybe too quick of evaluation of his book. But I wanted to move on to his second book, and this one is Know Who You Are, Live Like It Matters. And if you have a young person in your life, maybe you have a child, a grandchild, a niece, nephew, this would be a book because it's just full of lots of great material, but there's a lot of fill-in-the-blanks kinds of things. And if they were to take this seriously, this would really begin to get the ideas of shaken and biblical principles into their lives. So I just wanted to pick out four sections of the book and just, again, give you some key verses that he talks about, some things he's encouraging young people to memorize, and maybe we as older individuals could learn from some of the things he's passing on to them as well. One thing he suggests for these young people is to describe your spiritual birthday. Now, that's a really good idea. If you've ever taken our class here on evangelism, we actually encourage you to write out your testimony. And if somebody were to come up to you right now and ask, you know, when did you become a Christian? How did you become a Christian? And has it made any difference in your life? What would you say? And I think you should be ready to be able to give that answer. And he says this to the young people because it's important for them to remember, in some respects, what their life was before. Now, if you become a Christian at the age of 4, your life before isn't a great deal. But for some of us, we, you know, the pre-Christian days are pretty, you know, pretty different from the post-Christian days. And so he wants us to, first of all, think about our spiritual birthday and its implication. Then he put down a couple of key verses in a couple of the chapters, which I picked out two that I thought were very helpful. Again, these might be ones you put down and you might want to put on an index card or put on a refrigerator or put on a screensaver just to remind you of those. And the first is this idea that God has really created us to be significant and special. Ephesians 2:10. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand so that we would walk in them. So the first thing is that we are his workmanship. Second of all, also put down Proverbs 5:21, for the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he watches all his paths. I think this is really helpful to recognize that there are times when you just say, God, are you really even watching? How many times sometimes when we pray and we say, Lord, are you even paying attention? Are you aware of the difficulty I'm facing? This is a great promise in the Proverbs to claim that God's eyes are watching to and fro, and he is aware of what is happening in our world. So that's the first area in terms of kind of discovering who we are and our purpose. The second, he deals with this whole issue of fear and love. And first of all, he says, you know, failure is not an option. I quoted from Jeremiah 29:11. Here's Jeremiah 8:4. And I never really paid attention to this verse until I found this in the book. Because here, God is saying, interestingly enough, when you stumble and fall, you get back up. And if you take a wrong road, you turn around and go back. Now, I've said that to my kids, and I've said it to myself, but I didn't realize I had a verse in the scripture that actually emphasizes that. And then he talks about this idea that really if we're going to deal with fear, which sometimes is so incapacitating in our life, that we should recognize that fear is the way to cast out love. And he has a chapter called Fear Meet Love. 1 John 4:19. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. And then finally, to really encourage some of these young people to be bold, he quotes a course from Joshua 1:9. Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or discouraged, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. And so again, just a great promise to hold on to in terms of boldness and learning to stand up for biblical principles. Okay, two more. The next one had to do with this idea of these other people. And again, these are some other verses we would add to what we found in Shaken. One of the key verses he mentions there is in Ecclesiastes 4, verse 12. A person standing alone can be attacked and defeated, but two can stand back to back and conquer, and three are even better, for a triple braided cord is not easily broken. Once again, an emphasis upon who's in your circle of trust, who's in that trusted area of individuals. And then he asks the question of these young people, but it's a good question to ask ourselves. What kind of friend are you? Got a whole section in there about this. And one of the key verses that he puts there is in Proverbs 18, verse 24. A real friend sticks closer than a brother. And he asks, are you that kind of friend? Do you have that kind of friend? Do you have somebody that sticks closer than a brother? And then finally, again, talking about this idea of wisdom, we talked about one of the verses before, but here's another one that he added to. Proverbs 1, 5, a wise man will hear and increase in learning, and a man of understanding will acquire wise counsel. And of course, the scriptures talk about there is wisdom in godly counsel. So we certainly see that as well in terms of other people. Then the final point in the book I wanted to get on to is terms of our priorities. What are our priorities? How do we think through some of those issues? And again, probably one of the classic verses would be in Matthew 6, where Jesus says, do not store for yourself treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store for yourself treasures in heaven, where neither rust nor moth destroys and where thieves do not break in to steal. So again, what priority do you have? Are you laying up treasures on earth? Or are you laying up treasures in heaven? And then finally, one other verse which relates to some of the things we looked at a couple of weeks ago when we were in 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians 13:13. Three things will last forever: faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these is love. With that, I thought if you wouldn't mind, I would show you one other short clip from Tim Tebow when he was on with Sean Hannity, because he emphasizes this particular verse as well.
Welcome back to Hannity. So former NFL quarterback, now professional baseball player, Tim Tebow is out with a brand new book. It's called Shaken, Discovering Your True Identity in the Midst of Life Storms. In it, Tebow writes about some of the most challenging times in his career and how his faith helped him through it. And joining us now in the studio, how are you? Good to see you again. How you been?
Thanks for having me, man.
You know, you say there's something in the book, just because you have faith, and I'm a Christian, I'm probably not as good as you.
But it's not about being good. No. That's the great thing about Christianity.
Yeah, that's true.
It's not about what we do.
I get to keep doing bad and saying I'm sorry, I know. But in all honesty, I mean, I love that you have been so outspoken with your faith. I think you've been punished for it. And I think it's like, I don't understand these teams. If you are on a team, everybody in the stands has Tebow's shirts on. I mean, it's crazy, right?
Well, there'll probably be a few of them.
I was mad at my Jets for not using you better.
Yeah, that one didn't work out too well, I got to be honest. But
you told a story when you got called in by the Patriots. You were there, and you went to Coach Belichick, who I admire a lot, and said, hey, I got $1 million offer for one day's work. And he said, don't do it. Tell the story.
Well, you know, I wanted to be respectful because I needed to be a teammate. I needed to fall in line and, you know, stay under the radar. And so I was respectful of him. That's something we talked about the day, you know, that I signed there. And so I went into him with the presentation of, hey, this is what they want me to do. It's something I would do. But what do you think? He said, I would appreciate it if you turned it down. I said, yes, sir, no problem. It's done.
3 weeks later.
Yeah, I got cut from the team. But, you know, I don't regret that, or I'm not bitter at him for that. It was an amazing opportunity. opportunity. I think for me, more than anything, I was just disappointed because I thought, hey, I'm going to learn from Tom Brady, the best to ever do it.
And he's really great.
He is. And then he's going to retire, and I'll play for Coach Belichick, and we'll win all these Super Bowls, and it will be amazing. And, you know, then I get cut from the team, and it felt like a sucker punch. I remember flying home that day to Jacksonville and sitting on the edge of my bed thinking, I have no home, no car, no one wants me to do what I want to do. And, you know, this book is written for times like that where you feels like everything around you is shaken. Now what do I do? What do I hold on to? What is my foundation? And, you know, so many times in life, we feel like we're defined by certain things. Our identity is found in certain things. And what happens when those things crumble? What happens when you're an NFL player and that goes wrong? What happens when, you know, you find your identity in a relationship and it goes bad? What happens when you find it in a job and you lose it? That's what this book touches on. And the goal really of this book was, if you pick it up with your head down, you finish the book with your head held high, knowing that God has an awesome plan for your life, you matter and you are important, and that's a bigger identity than anything that the world could ever
offer.
But
don't you think, I know you're trying with the Mets, you got the first pitch and you knocked it out of the park, the first pitch? What are you, Mark Teixeira or something? I mean, what's that? That's crazy.
Yeah, not quite, but I tell you what, I got a little lucky on that one, so that was fun.
But you really did well. I noticed the end of your season you did really well. What is your plan? Hopefully to make
continue training and then spring training, figure out where they want me to go and take it from there. But, you know, it's just so cool and it's such a blessing that I get to pursue two sports that I loved ever since I was 4 years old and play both of them and have a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, listen, we wish you the best. Seriously.
Thanks,
the book is awesome.
It.
And you know what? You're a great example for kids. I know a lot
Thank
of athletes. I don't know. It seems the more controversial, the more notoriety they get from kids. But you were able to bring another side to them, which is, you know,
well, I think that's the awesome thing about sports is if all you do is win or lose a game or score touchdowns or hit home runs, people are going to forget about that. It doesn't really matter. But if you can transcend whatever sport you're playing to impact people's lives, to put a smile on their face or bring faith, hope, and love, then you're doing
something. How many lives have you saved since you've been playing baseball? How many? You saved the one guy in the stands' life.
I don't know if I've saved any. I've been blessed to be there to support some people. So
One guy in a plane, one guy in the stands. If I have a heart attack now, I don't forget it. I don't need it. Just let me go. I'm coming home, Elizabeth. I don't know if you remember that sitcom. Tim Tebow, good book. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's something. You know, Tim Tebow said something that was reinforced today by O.S. Hawkins. You know, we tend to forget about very important people, but we do see the influence of very influential people. And I think he certainly is one of those. Do we have time for just a short answer to the question? Okay, one of the questions that we always like to put up here is, if you have questions, you can fill out the form or you can just send them to me or email them. And as I mentioned earlier, Gwen was the one that said, you know, help me understand this. You know, when we look at our Bible, even in Genesis, it seems to give us at least a little bit of a hint of the idea of Trinity. So how did Jewish people miss the idea of the Trinity when you got passages like Genesis 1:26 that said, let us make man in our image after our likeness? Us, our. Kind of hard to miss, right? You know, you got the pronouns that seem to suggest a little bit more. And you'd think, well, perhaps they would miss this in the Old Testament, but now that we have the additional revelation in the New Testament, along with really centuries of Christian teaching, that should show them the truth, right? Now, let me just quote from one Jewish scholar, Rabbi Stanley Greenberg of Temple Sinai in Philadelphia, who said this: Christians are, of course, entitled to believe in a Trinitarian conception of God, but their effort to base their conception on the Hebrew Bible must fly in the face of the overwhelming story of that Bible. Hebrew scriptures are clear and unequivocal on the oneness of God. So even now you have Jewish scholars saying that. Okay, so let's respond to that for just a minute because, you know, Gwen asked a good question, but I want to broaden it. How do we deal with this issue when we maybe talk to our Jewish friends or others that have questions about the Trinity? And so let's go back to the first word that we see there, and that is the Hebrew word for God is Elohim. Now, as I said before, sometimes this is going to sound like a seminary class, so I'm not going to get deep into Hebrew, but I'm going to give you a little bit here so that you'll have a tool for your evangelism toolbox. And Elohim is the plural noun because it won't teach you all of Hebrew, but if it ends in im, that's plural. So the word Elohim is in the plural. So that's right off the bat. It is a word used in Genesis 1:1. It's also used in Deuteronomy 20, verse 3. That's the Ten Commandments. And it's also used in Deuteronomy 13, verse 2, where it talks about other gods. Once you look at that, you can see how then some of the Jewish people try to respond to that. Because they'll say, okay, yes, it's plural, but it's whether or not that plural noun is used with a plural or singular verb. So let's get their answer. First, they'll say that the word Elohim, which is the name for God, is plural, but when it's used with a singular verb, it's talking about the one true God, who we would call Yahweh. They would say then that this word Elohim, which is in the plural, when it's used with a plural verb, well, then it's talking about false gods. Okay, we do see that in Deuteronomy, but this is a rule that has all sorts of exceptions. Because, if nothing else, there are places where the plural verb is used with the plural noun when it's obviously talking about God the Father, the God of the Bible. And I give you a couple of examples. Genesis 20, 2 Samuel 7, and Psalm 58. So the answer isn't a very good answer, is it? Because it's an attempt to try to say, well, that's a little bit different. And, of course, if you think about it, the word Elohim has plurality in it, which I think opens very easily the idea of the Trinity. So you might say, okay, but well then why then do we always have that? Because God often, when he speaks to himself, uses a plural pronoun. Let's take a couple of examples. In Genesis 1:26, then God, that's the Greek, Hebrew word Elohim, said, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness." So again, you have this idea of plurality. Now, some people have said, well, yes, but maybe he's referring to himself as maybe the we. You know, sometimes the Queen of England talks about we, and you're going, who's we? Some of you Dirty Harry fans are thinking already. Remember when Dirty Harry walks into that restaurant and there are various robbers there? And what does he say to them? Well, we aren't going to let you just walk out of here. And the robber says, who's we, sucker? And he says, what? Smith and Wesson and me. Okay, I even got a Dirty Harry one when teaching Hebrew, right? Okay, very good. That doesn't work very well because that's not really the context at all. Some say maybe, well, maybe he's referring to angels. That doesn't work because he's referring to our image, and we're in the image of God, not in the image of angels. You see all these arguments that are used against the Trinity. Not real good arguments. And so I give you Genesis 1:26, I give you Genesis 3:22. Let's go to Isaiah 6, verse 8. What happens there? Isaiah is lamenting the death of the ruler, and in the midst of this, God opens up the heavens, and now he sees the heavenly world. And at this point, then, God says, who shall we what? Send, right? Who will go forward for us? Again, that plural. And you have the Godhead talking among themselves. Who's going to be our missionary? And so you just have lots of examples like that. Okay, so the kind of the final fallback for a Jewish person is the Shema. Now, what's the Shema? Well, the Shema is found in Deuteronomy 6:4. You go to Israel. To this day, you'll see mezuzahs, and they'll have the Shema in there. And it's, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." Okay, well, that does it. God is one. He's not a plural. Well, turns out that didn't work very well either. This is the best argument from our Jewish friends, and it's not a very good argument. Because the very words "our God" are actually in the plural. We just talked about that. Elohim. So it's already plural. Second of all, well, what about this word "one"? Well, it turns out that one can be used in terms of an absolute one, but there are many places where the Hebrew word translated one can mean a what? Compound one. It's the Hebrew word echad, and it means a compound one, and we see this in Genesis. For those of us that have ever looked at creation, it talks about, in Genesis 1, an evening and a morning, but are called what? One day. So you have, it could also be a compound one. So even the best argument against the Trinity, which would be the Shema, which is repeated by all Orthodox Jews every single day, numerous times, even that, using the word one, I think that Hebrew word echad for one could simply be a compound one. Does that help answer that? But again, if you start with the assumption that God is one and the Trinity is impossible, you can see the situation. Is it possible that someday Jewish people will once again slap their foreheads and see their Messiah? That's what the book of Revelation is all about, isn't it? And so that is the case. And in the book of Romans, Paul talks about the fact that there was a blindness to the Jewish generation. And sometimes when you try to even present some of this can be found in a very good article in Jews for Jesus, you might as well be talking to the wall because they just can't see it because of a preconceived bias. But nevertheless, I would have to say that all through the Hebrew Scriptures, we have very good evidence for the Trinity. So Gwen, thanks for asking the question. Probably gave you a longer answer than you wanted to hear, but nevertheless, that is the case. And when we come to the Old and New Testament, then it's real simple because, as I pointed out, of course, we have the word Elohim in the plural, and then we can see there are places where God is quoted in different ways. God the Father oftentimes in the Old Testament is called Yahweh. God the Son, or Jesus, is sometimes called the angel of Yahweh or the servant of Yahweh. We see that in the pre-incarnate manifestations of Jesus Christ. And God the Spirit is referred to as the Spirit of Yahweh or the Spirit of God. So you can even see in the way that's described even in the Old Testament. But of course the New Testament provides much more biblical perspective on that. But even just looking at the Hebrew Old Testament, despite what this rabbi in Philadelphia says, I think you can still make a pretty good case for the Trinity, even in the Old Testament. Certainly we can see how it is fleshed out in the New Testament. Well, let me just get ready for next week. Next week we're going to move on to this book, and the movie's coming out, so I'm going to play the trailer for it as well. Renee Zellweger is playing in that, all sorts of other people. Same kind of different as me, so we'll focus some of our time and attention on that book. But again, it's pretty short because it's a fairly short story, but we'll kind of go through the story. And then I thought that since some of you will still be here next week, those of you that aren't taking off to the hinterlands to watch the eclipse, Parker will be one of those up there in Carbondale, Illinois. I thought I would take a little bit from the book Privileged Planet, because the reason Guillermo Gonzalez said he wrote the book was because one time he was watching a full total eclipse. And when he saw the eclipse, he began to say, is that possibly evidence of God's fingerprints? So next week we're going to talk about why a solar eclipse could be a very powerful argument for God. And we'll kind of get you ready for the eclipse, which will take place on the 21st. And Parker's coming forward, so let's give him an applause for what he did today in the worship service.